Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Grayscale Gorilla Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. Happy April, everybody. Happy April Fools. Anything good happen on April Fools there, Chad?
Oh, yeah. Lots of trickery.
How you been, Chris?
Lots of fake cockroaches and poop. Fake poop.
Oh, that's classic. Classic April Fools. Chris, how you been?
Doing well, doing well. Didn't do any good pranks this year. I guess Easter kind of messed up the overall vibe of it, so... We were over at our grandparents' house and kind of mean to do stuff to them.
Lovely. Yeah, it's not an intergenerational situation. You got to prank your friends. Prank your peers, folks.
Prank little your message.
Prank or kids. Prank your kids. Welcome to the Grayscale Girl Podcast. We have a fun show today. We're going to do an AMA. We reached out last week and said, hey, if you had any questions for us, any topics you want us to talk about, put it on Twitter, put it on YouTube, and we got a lot of good questions. We're going to be going through those in just a minute. But first, a little bit of follow-up, a little bit of front matter, a little bit of all that. NAB. NAB is coming up next week. We are going to be there. And we're really excited. It's going to be a huge NAB for us, and there's so much going on. And so I wanted to let you guys know, if you're going to be in Vegas for NAB, which if you don't know what NAB is, it's a trade show. It's probably the biggest trade show for our industry. It's for all film and all not quite film, like all broadcasting. There you go. It's right there. It's right there in the title. It's for the broadcasters, the software, the hardware, the cameras, everything you need to put stuff on TV is at Vegas at this one event, and we're gonna be there. Grayscale Gorilla team will be there. We have some presentations over at the Maxon booth. Where Chris and I have some talks we're putting together right now. I know I'm excited for mine. Chris, how's yours going?
Good. I just got the whole thing wrapped up last night. I actually have to trim a bunch of stuff down, so I get to put the best information in there. We're also going to be doing a live AskGSG from the Maxon stage.
That's right. That's right. Wednesday, I think. Yeah. So if you want to see the schedule of all the presenters, they have an amazing lineup of presenters this year. Go to c4dlive.com. And as always, we try to keep the show notes up to date. If you're watching this on YouTube, it should be down in the description. If you're listening on iTunes, how you doing? Hope you're doing well. Check out our blog post, which we always put up with each individual podcast. We have a little blog post that goes with it, with all these notes in it. So C4D Live, if you want to see all the great presenters, including Chris and our times. Put it up there. Happy Monday. Come say hi. If you're in Vegas, if you're in the show, look for us. We'll be around the show floor. We'll be visiting, friends and other booths around the show floor. So keep an eye out for us. And if you're going to be in town, by Sunday, this Sunday, actually, we are having the NAB party. And so we're helping sponsor this giant party. It started off with a few of us kind of getting together and wanting to hang out with our friends and people in town. And it turned into what is now over 600 people that have signed up to this basically motion design party. So if you want to learn more about it, I'm going to put the link down in the description here.
Are there still tickets for that?
Yeah, I think there are just a few.
How many people can that place hold? It seems like a lot of people.
It's probably maybe 1,000. Yeah, we basically rented out the entire beer bar for that night. And
that's a good place.
That's cool.
Yeah, so we would love to see you there. And I'm going to get all this. I'm trying to find the original post just so we could link it.
The escalation of this event is crazy, because if you think of this as a similar event that we did a year ago at that same place when we met up with Joey from School of Motion, right. There was what, 11 people? And this year there's 600. So what's it going to be next year?
Yeah, come on by. It's going to be amazing. We have... it's sponsored by Video Copilot, School of Motion, Grayscale Gorilla, MoGraph Mentor, The Future, AE Scripts, AE Plugins, and Maxon and Red Giant.
Lineup.
What a lineup. So come on by. It's going to be quite the party. We would love to meet you. Come say hi. Come have a beer on us. We'd love to meet you and just meet the community. Like that's what we do here. That's what Grayscale Gorilla is about. We want to help the motion design community. And so anybody out there that wants to hang out and you know, have a beer or not have a beer, you can have a soda. It's fine too. Just come say hi. We'd love to meet you.
Whiskey, if you're at all. Bourbon.
Whiskey's fine.
Oh, if, lots of bourbon.
If you are near the Vegas area this Sunday, please come say hi. And I just saw that they on the School of Motion article about this party, they have this giant photo of all of us, you know, given the little smile at the camera. And at the bottom they wrote, Nick Campbell smiles with his eyes. I thought that was kind of nice. That was very sweet. Thank you guys. That's very cute. I appreciate that. I got my mom's smile. All right. That is NAB. We would love to see you. Chris, you have an update about 5 Second Projects.
I sure do. For most people, this is going to be kind of the announcement. 5 Second Projects are back. Grayscale Grill is officially doing them again.
Yeah, baby.
So what we did, if you aren't familiar, is, well, first of all, what is 5 Second Projects? This is an event that Nick would run every single month for a while, like 8 years ago or something, you started it. Mm-hmm. And the idea is you just make some sort of motion graphics piece and it has to be exactly 5 seconds long. And it could be Cinema 4D, it could be Maya, it could be After Effects, it could be stop motion. As long as it's not just live action, then it qualifies. And people come together and you put it, you upload it to YouTube, and we compile all of them and we look through them all and we announce some winners. And it's just kind of a fun thing for people to practice and learn and get critique from their peers. And it's just a whole bunch of fun. It's a really good excuse to do something on a specific topic, to make an animation, to know that other people are going to see it and that you're kind of competing with people. It's just really fun. It's a great way to learn. And geez, like 8 years ago, I'm shocked when you're kind of bringing it back. I was looking through some of the old blog posts and a bunch of people that we're like friends with that do amazing work were like starting out doing some 5 Second Projects. Like, it's amazing where some people have gone with it. So we actually ran a trial of this kind of a month ago, just in the Grayscale Gorilla Connect, the GSG Connect Slack channel. And we wanted to check a new process and get it all working really well. And that worked great. So now we are doing a big old full announcement to everybody. So this month's topic is going to be, oh, dang it. I've just forgot. I wrote it down too. But like we got it. What's that?
Well, you were looking for the topic?
No, I just sent it to you guys, and now I've forgotten the...
Was it Playgrounds?
Oh, yeah. Playground? Thank you, Nick. I've got such a large list of ideas for it.
That's what I thought, too. Topic, I was like, I thought I said it, but...
For some reason, in my head, it was turning into spring cleaning, but it's actually Playgrounds.
The official we know what you're doing this week.
Topic is Playground. So go over to, we've got a link in the notes to go to the official page. You can see all the rules, which there's not too many as long as it's 5 seconds long. And it should be super fun. I'm really excited to bring it back. So,
yeah, this I'm very excited too. If you've ever participated in a 5 second project, you know the power of having a deadline, having a limited amount of animation time, and I think a big part of this, Chris was saying this earlier, is the competition is we pick a winner. We send it through our friends and in the company, and we kind of vote on some of our favorites. And, you know, there's not a big prize or anything, physically, but it's just the fact that you are putting your work up against a lot of other people. I think that is a big part of it. I think, we don't have to talk this could turn into a topic on its own. We have some other questions to answer. But to me, some of the things that you don't get when you're learning motion design early on is this understanding that of the actual job of motion graphics, the actual pitching of ideas, the actual telling a story, the actual doing work on a deadline in a short amount of time. All those things are such a big part of our industry that don't come across in tutorials, you know? And the 5 second projects are such a great way to flex those muscles. It's like if you only do bicep curls and you don't work out your legs, you know, this is like a well-rounded way to get your brain into the idea of having a deadline, working with other people, having other people's work next to yours. There's an element of, there's deadlines, there's all this stuff. So anyway, if you're looking to like do this next thing in your career to like help out your skills or learn something new or try out a new piece of software, 5 Second Projects are just such a great place to do that. So hope to see you in there. We're going to link that up in the description as well. And you can learn more about 5 Second Projects. And we'd love to see your animation. That's super exciting.
What was the first topic
ever?
Back in the day? So the first topic, Chad, this may blow your mind. Chad Ashley participated in the very first 5 Second Project.
What?
I thought it was the second or third, but it's the first one?
Yep. It wasn't even called 5 Second Projects. It was just, we came up with the idea that there should be a small little topic that we like set for ourselves, and then we all make an animation. And the first topic was called 5 Seconds in Orange. And it just so happened that the 5 Seconds part of that project stuck. So as it moved forward, the 5 Second thing kind of stuck around, and then it turned into, you know, coffee and triangles, I think was like the second one. And then there was black and white balloons. And there's like all these little kind of words that you could put together to say, look, it's got to be black and white. It's got to have to do with balloons, and it's got to be 5 seconds. And
can't find it. Oh, I can't.
We got a link to yours because your sphere animation, I still like love. That's like almost 9 years old now, 10 years old, maybe.
I kept scrolling back to the oldest one on the blog. And in December of 2012, there was a topic, huge mustache.
Yeah, that's like the reboot. That was like this first reboot.
Interesting.
Yeah. Was, I think, because maybe Ivan had to do with that one because of the mustache. Oh, I forget. Anyway, 5 Second Projects. Learn more. Click down below, and we'll be announcing winners and talking about that more and more. It's just such a fun part of learning. We really enjoy seeing those videos come in. All right. So can you believe, isn't that crazy, Chad? You did That's the first crazy. 5 Second Project.
That's nuts, dude. I can remember it, and I remember even the sound effects, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't find it anywhere.
Yeah, and actually, if you're interested, you can go back and watch my first 5 Second Project, which was the same one. It was 5 Seconds in Orange, and I did a tutorial on how I made that animation. Now it's in After Effects, but if you're interested, let's link that as well. I'm gonna put a reminder here: 5 Seconds in Orange, and okay, cool. All right, let's head on into the topic, which is our AMA, which is the Ask Me Anything, Ask Us Anything, AUA. That's what today is all about.
Yeah. Well, also, I kind of want to throw out there that one of the reasons that we're doing an AMA style episode is because this is episode 99 of the Grayscale Gorilla podcast.
That's right. That's
crazy.
We have something special planned for 100. So I'm excited to get that going. But 99. Thanks for doing all this 99 episodes, guys.
Yeah, fun. When did we start this format?
Like format was around episode 40 or 50.
Oh, really? Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, so
it's pretty good.
Yeah, let's call it a win.
Are we ready for official questions?
Yeah, I'm ready. Thanks to everybody that thrown in questions. We're going to try to get to them all, but if we miss yours, we apologize. But yeah, Chris, you want to throw it out there, and we'll just kind of
bat it around.
Yeah, bat it. That's it. Bat it around.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the first one is a question we got off of Twitter, and they're asking what our opinion is on Cinema 4D for VFX and VFX Studios.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think VFX Create Studios might be their name.
Oh, is it? That's a very appropriate question for them to ask. Well, what's our opinion?
It's a good question for them.
Yeah. They should know that one with the name, you know. I mean, I've seen good VFX with Cinema 4D for sure. I don't have I've never personally been into VFX, you know, like I haven't done a ton of VFX in cinema, other than some basic camera tracking and some, you know, some tutorials based on that. But I don't know. How much have you guys seen in the industry with Cinema 4D and VFX? I feel like it's out there.
It's out there, but not a ton. Not a ton of it.
Do you think it's based on any specific reason, or do you think it's just like, you know, some tools just become the tool for things? Like Cinema 4D is clearly killing it in motion design and motion graphics. And is that it? Is it just the reputation puts people off to use it for VFX?
Well, no, I think that VFX is, when you think about VFX, it's really three apps that dominate VFX, and that's Maya, Houdini, and 3ds Max. Now, 3ds Max, you might be like, well, really 3ds Max? Well, actually, they are pretty widely used in TV VFX. That's because there's lots of studios using 3ds Max for TV VFX, mainly because of the ability to use fume effects for doing volumetric smoke, fire. And typically, VFX 3D is a lot of those things. It's a lot of fire, it's a lot of smoke, explosions, that sort of thing. And so that is why that tool is predominantly used, because of that plugin for 3ds Max. Now, Maya and Houdini, it's pretty obvious that they can create some of those things on their own, Houdini especially. So that's another reason why those are widely used. I think where you're seeing Cinema 4D start to get into that space a little bit more is the dynamics are great. It doesn't have an ability to do smoke or liquid fumed effects type of stuff natively, but you can get pretty good results with X particles, and you can get pretty good results with Turbulence FD. In my opinion, not quite as awesome as what you'd see with Houdini or with fume effects based on what I've seen, but pretty close. And I think that if Cinema 4D were to try to get more into VFX, they would have to have like some sort of native solution for doing really awesome smoke, destruction, fire. I think even the Voronoi fracture was actually a pretty cool thing and opened up a lot of people's eyes, like, whoa, maybe I could do this shatter effect in Cinema and not have to jump out to Houdini.
Well, a lot of the limitations along those lines are needing these systems to interact with each other. So that's where a lot of the plugins, they do a great job, but you know, it's really like we want soft body dynamic. Well, we've got soft body dynamics, but it's almost like you want cloth dynamics to be able to interact with simulation, interact with particles, also interact with the dynamics happening. And then where a collision happens, it makes smoke. And some of that stuff can be maybe a little bit more tedious in Cinema. So I think that's where you definitely see the motion graphics rather than just like throwing, like, okay, I need a million fractured points to collapse with smoke coming out from it. It's like, that's not a casual thing to do in Cinema.
Right.
I've definitely been seeing more and more, especially like at NAB, I feel like more and more I've been seeing demos at the Maxon booth with Cinema 4D of VFX. And so I think the word's, you know, getting out in general about this tool. And I have a feeling too that, the word's of course getting out about Cinema 4D, it's amazing, but it's getting out that it's more capable than at first glance. And then so as people like you, Chad, right, we talk about your process of like kind of discovering Cinema 4D after using these other apps for so long, as you learn more about what Cinema can do, and then someone like you gets a more VFX style job, you can go like, oh, okay, this will be fine for this type of job, actually. You know, like connecting those dots backwards a little bit. So I've definitely seen more in the last couple of years for sure.
And I think too, like VFX is sort of this blurry line now, because a lot of when I was at a studio, people would say motion design, and that could mean so many things. Like a lot of what we did would be considered VFX, not even motion design, yet we were a motion design studio doing VFX jobs. So it's not, it's a very blurry line, and I think that as it becomes more accessible to do photoreal effects in all sorts of different applications, you're going to start seeing artists picking up tools that maybe weren't necessarily marketed towards VFX, but using them for VFX because they're capable. I think if you look at Cinema, I think the only thing in my head that's like, I just wouldn't use it for that would be, and that's only because I haven't tried it yet. I haven't really done a lot of smoke effects in Cinema. I used to do a lot in Max with fume effects. Got a lot of jobs with those, with atmospheric smoke and fire and all that sort of thing when I was doing 3ds Max. I haven't looked at what I think a lot of people use is Turbulence FD. I need to do it. I haven't had time, but that'd be the one thing that I'd be like, oh, I'm not really sure I would use it for that, but maybe.
You were saying you were doing a lot of motion graphics pieces where you wouldn't even consider it VFX, but I guess that's where you could do a lot of really fun stylized VFX in Cinema 4D pretty quickly and pretty well. It's like, oh, a stylized liquid, we could do that. A stylized like bit of particles or smoke, like it's a little more cartoony and intentionally so. And where it's like, okay, if you want to, a lot of VFX, the high-end stuff, is you're trying to get photorealistic. And that's just in general going to be a lot trickier. Everything needs to be more precise, more, you know, another order of magnitude or two of particle density and like volumetric effects. So just, there's so many additional layers. So you can do all of that in cinema, but as a general rule, if you're kind of casually doing it, it's going to be a smaller scale and smaller scope.
Yeah. Well, all right, I think we did it. I think if we're gonna get to all these questions, we should roll
move on. Oh yeah, that's true. Okay, this should be a pretty quick one. John on YouTube was asking, and this is specifically for Nick, how much for your Mac?
How much for your Mac? You make an offer. I'm in. You probably mean how much did I pay for it? So any hardware, that goes for all of us. If anybody wants to know what we're currently using, we actually set up a page just for this question. And if you go to grayscalegorilla.com and you just click on the resources page, we add our current machine in there. And then what you could do then is like, you know, put that into eBay and see what it's worth right now and like get our actual stuff that we're using. And so our machines, you know, we're always upgrading, and like I'm getting a new machine this year, maybe a PC. We'll talk about that another time. I know, Chris, you're looking at a new machine. You sometimes use your laptop, sometimes use. So if you're ever interested in any of our hardware, across any of our tutorials that you've seen, we made a specific section at grayscalegorilla.com/resources. And we'll put the link up in the show notes as well. And you could just see what that is. My general take on just buying a machine for almost anybody is, you know, use a platform you're comfortable with. That is changing more and more every day as people are moving the PC reluctantly in many, many ways. But I would say, first, be comfortable with your platform. Second of all, spend as much money as you physically can on a machine. If you're doing this for a living, this is the number one tool that you are buying to potentially speed up your workflow. And it's literally the machine you're interacting with all day long. So whatever that means to you, as much money as possible, take that as it is. We are in one of the only industries that can just max out a current computer and still need more power. Almost every other industry right now is like, I'm fine with a MacBook Air because I just do internet.
I just do email.
I just do like, you know, a little bit of Photoshop, and everything's fast enough. But we are in this rare industry where we are so still very power hungry with, you know, and I mean physical like energy. You need a lot of GPUs these days. You need a lot of chips. So the answer is, you know, the biggest machine possible. And that's what I've tried to do throughout my career. When I was a broke college student, I got the like second best machine I could because I couldn't afford the brand new stuff, right? It was always like double the price for the new one. So I got like last year's best machine. And as you know, grew the business and we're able to afford more expensive machines, crank up the RAM, crank up the chips, crank up the SSD drives. That's just my general advice for anybody out there doing this for a living. Now, if you're a hobbyist, use what you got, play with what you got. It's fine. You know, go get a coffee and render. Maybe, you know, use a friend's machine or set up a team render hack job or something. But if you're doing this for a living, get the best one you can afford. That's my general advice.
And you get what you pay for.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the rare industries that we are in where our work will take as many chips and as many GPUs as we could throw at it, depending on your renderer, of course. So yeah,
hopefully. For sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a quick technical question, but I think we might be able to answer it. How do you get rid of flickering in physical renderer and specifically from ambient occlusion?
I think I have the fast answer for this one. I'm gonna open up Cinema to make sure I don't do the wrong language here. And maybe And I feel like we have this tutorial somehow.
We probably, first of all, we probably have a tutorial somewhere. And then I'm going to actually, well, Nick finds the actual answer. I'm going to give the super duper fast answer. And that is, if you own HDRI Studio or if you own Topcoat from Grayscale Gorilla, Nick had designed like some optimized physical renderer render settings. And you just click a button and kind of get all your render settings with one click. And I've become almost completely dependent on that. If I'm doing something quickly, not final, you know, I guess you can also do final render, but I so rarely do final renders. But it's like, we need some nice looking ambient occlusion. Click the button. Boom, I've got my ambient occlusion set up. So that's always been a great solution. But the technical solution Nick's got for you.
Yeah, so those are based on the, like those presets are based on the idea that the irradiance cache is dead to me. Okay. That the real key right now is if you turn on, and what I'm doing is I'm assuming that they're saying ambient occlusion, but I'm throwing global illumination in there because that's where I see more flickering.
Yeah. I was going to say, you don't really see flicker from ambient occlusion.
Yeah. I'm kind of assuming that they're talking about global illumination, and Chris, it sounded like you were too. In general, to me, the biggest problem is the default setting for global illumination is irradiance cache. And I think it's never worked well for me. It's not faster and it's always flickery to me. Maybe I don't know how to use it. That's fine. But to me, using QMC, which is the Quasi Monte Carlo, and then using your physical render settings to like crank up and down your samples is much more stable. Now it's a lot noisier, right? It's a lot grainier than irradiance cache, but if you're doing animation, it's a faster for me and it's less flickery. You get less of the weird flicker. But then all
blotchy.
You have to, yeah, you get, yeah, right. No blotches, but you, then all you have to worry about is grain, and there's third party grain solutions to like run in After Effects to get rid of grain. And then you basically are just solving for grain versus time at that point. And so that's what a lot of those presets are based on. We did a lot more, you know, stuff in the presets to speed them up. But the general idea is the QMC, switch to QMC and see how it goes. That's the advice I'd have to anybody having flickery, Cinema 4D, physical render, global illumination problems. That's a big word. That's a long sentence.
This one might be relatively quick, or let's try and do it pretty quick. But what are our general thoughts on motion graphics, specifically in VR and AR? So virtual reality and augmented reality. I don't keep up with the most up-to-date versions of the stuff that much. There are some cool VR applications starting to come out, and those are neat. I still think it's a novelty. I still think there's a little bit of a catch-22 going on where nobody's going to be trying to develop the killer VR app until there's wide adoption of VR. But there's not going to be wide adoption of VR until somebody makes a killer app that you absolutely need. And until that is solved, it's really tricky to see where that's going to end up being. But along those lines, I'm just excited in general for the prospect of AR. Like when I'm getting to look through my phone and see like a map overlaid on the world, like that's like the most generic application of it I can picture, but it's also kind of the coolest. Like when you're just like, you picture like your car windshield showing you the route you should turn and whatnot. That the idea of that kind of thing is really cool. And the promise of that is the only thing that keeps my hope alive for this kind of VR AR stuff. So, I don't know where you guys fall on that.
I consume it. I look at it as a consumer. I don't really follow the tech. I don't really follow the apps and all of that sort of thing. But I do consume it on my phone through the Google AR stickers, which are like the only experience that I really have in AR. Of course, VR, I've done, you know, the different flavors of VR. I'm not really a big fan of VR. It sort of makes me sick to my stomach, and it just, I get motion sickness from it. But AR is cool and fun. I don't know. I honestly don't have an opinion about how it's going to impact motion design or that sort of thing. It's fun as a consumer. I haven't found anything that I'm like, I can't live without it yet. But I think it's interesting. I think AR is more interesting to me than VR.
Yeah, I mean, this is an old trope for me, but I think anytime that there's new tech and we're not sure of where it's going to go or how it's going to work, I always remember that. I always remember to try to bring as many things into the new tech as you can from your old kind of situation. So that's a little unclear, but to me, it's like whether it's VR, AR, what's going to happen in the future? Well, it's going to be more pixels and more screens, right? So that, like, right now we have a bunch of glowing rectangles around us and we're designing for that. Whether it's a TV or a computer or an iPad or a phone, it's glowing rectangles. And in the future, if VR, AR allows us to, like, not necessarily look at a glowing rectangle, but look at a glowing 360 sphere, however that manifests itself on our eyes, then it's just more pixels to animate for. And the need to hire an artist to either get communication, here's where I'm getting. You're either going to have to explain something or you're going to have to tell a story as an animator and as somebody that designs for like pixels. And so it, as long as you are always becoming better at those two things, then the tech can change, but the tech will always change to allow us to either tell a story or to get some sort of information across. So if it's maps and data and where you're going, that's information, right? That's like, how do you lay out a screen and lay out a system to tell you where to go, or some knowledge you need to know. Or maybe it's a commercial about, you know, selling a new product or whatever. You have to like hit those heartstrings. Those things won't change depending on where the tech goes. So whenever I'm in, like, I don't know where the industry is going to go, I try to take a little bit of a step back and go, okay, well, this means I need to double down on the things that won't change. Because the answer is I don't know if VR, AR is going to turn into like what 3D TVs turned into, which was just like a fad that kind of disappeared, or if it's actually going to be the thing. And I don't think any of us know. So to me, any of those questions for me make me take a step back and go, all right, what can I bring into any pixel based 3D situation and still be able to like work in this industry? Maybe that's not the answer, yeah. But
that's a good answer. So now we're jumping into questions that we got from the Grayscale Gorilla Connect on Slack.
Oh, awesome.
And Chris had a really long question, but I'm going to boil it down to pretty much, does Grayscale Gorilla have any kind of roadmap that we're willing to share? Like, what are stuff coming down the pipeline?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's to me, and I'd like to hear you guys too, but to me, I think the same thing. So like, what's our job? What do I consider Grayscale Gorilla's goal? Well, our goal is to help motion designers do their job as well as they can. So however that looks like is where we want to go. So if AR and VR takes over our industry, then you'll probably see some tutorials about that. I mean, this is long term, right? Like we our goal is to help you guys do your best work. Short term, where we're focusing on right now is training. It's something that we've been working on for over 10 years now, is how to communicate clearly online and creates interesting, compelling training that actually gets the point across and that is fun to watch and that is accurate, right? That so that at the end of this training, you can go on and start to do work on your own. That to me, even just when Grayscale Gorilla was just me, was always the goal. How can I teach in the best way possible in the shortest amount of time possible, but still get the gist of what I'm trying to say? And so to me, the short term, you know, within the next year is going to be a ton of new training from Grayscale Gorilla. We have some great plugins we're working on as well. We're excited about those. We won't stop putting out new plugins. But to me, the big new thing for this year, at least, is much more training. So, you know, if you've been watching the Gorilla Guide to X Particles, you have a sense of where we're going with how good training can be online. And there are people that have great training online and there are people that don't. And we've been trying to be on the good side of that. It's very important to us moving forward. But that, I don't know, that, without getting into like, you know, dates and yeah. Each individual thing.
No dates, please.
Anytime we see a date, or even honestly something that we're working on that's a little ways away, all we're doing is setting ourselves up for trouble. I've always appreciated that Maxon in Cinema 4D, they don't say anything until it's about ready to ship.
Right. And then you get excited because you could go play with it.
Yeah, but yeah, we're totally working on plugins. We got 5-second projects are back. A bunch more of what we're doing, more tutorials, more just cool things all around.
More, yeah. more, more.
more of everything. I mean, that's the short answer is more, right? Like we've put out over 500 hours of free training online on YouTube and Vimeo. We've put out dozens of plugins, won awards with plugins. We're focused on putting out good stuff, right? That's our goal. We want to help the community and help the designer get their best work done and help you show off. We want to make your client look at you and go like, wow, I can't believe you did this in an hour. And part of that is teaching design and how to actually like create this stuff emotionally. And part of it is the tech. And we want to make sure we're getting both sides. That's why we do this podcast, right? This is a little bit more of the behind the scenes stuff, a little bit more of the design and emotion and how we actually get work done. And then we have all this free tutorials and paid training and plugins to help you do your work faster. That's the general roadmap and how we see like being a part of this community.
Yes, sirree.
Thanks for the question. Let's see. That was from Chris. Thanks for the question, Chris.
The next one is from Ben. And it's a question for Nick. As an entrepreneur, are you looking to get into something new, maybe something off the 3D path? Do you think you will start getting more into different digital creative spaces like music or marketing, editing, sound design, or anything like that?
I don't know. Yeah, I could see that. My interest in music, in marketing and sound design and all that stuff. I mean, all that stuff stems and 3D, right? All this stuff for me personally, I guess that's all I could speak for is myself, but personally, it all comes from the idea that I love how things are created. I love behind the scenes. I love how things are made. I love knowing that humans make all this stuff and connecting the dots back to, you know, a beautiful piece of music, a beautiful film, a beautiful commercial, a speaker, the way this light is constructed down to like how to make a good cup of iced coffee. All of this comes down to a human at the back end of this, having a good idea, a process, or making art. And so anytime I can go behind the scenes and learn those things like music, I love music. I've been playing more drums, guitar, keyboard. I've been making, playing in Ableton, just loving that process. If there's a way to bring what I know about teaching and about, you know, online, like marketing, right? Like how to get the word out about, something interesting, I'll jump into that. Right. It's definitely always sometimes in the back of my mind, you know, but, are you looking to get into something new? I guess not actively, not right now. I think there's a lot more we could do with Grayscale Gorilla and what it's becoming and what we're doing. Frankly, my days are spent building this team and finding great people like Chris and Chad and our new marketing person Michael, which we haven't done an official thing. Kind of officially announce. What are we doing? This is like super behind the scenes. You want the super behind the scenes? I'm about to write a note to make a blog post on the podcast. That's the kind of day you want to know. The kind of day Nick has. That's the kind of day Nick has. Write a note to make the blog post to announce Michael. There you go. That's like the behind the scenes for me, right? My goal right now is to make sure that the team and Grayscale Gorilla and our partners and everyone we're working with that we are as good as we can be for them and build something long term that will help people in 2 and 5 and 10 years. After that, yeah, I'm probably gonna play more music. I don't know how that comes out entrepreneurially. Maybe I'll like teach kids how to play drums in the neighborhood or something. But yeah, music will always be a part of my life. How that manifests itself, I'm not sure, but I do like thinking about that. Question for Ben. If you know, I'm looking to put a band together. Let me know what you play. You know what I'm saying? Let me know.
Next up, this might also be from Ben. I'm not sure. There's not a name with it. Question for Chad and Chris. Do you plan on making or would we consider doing some bigger animation projects through Grayscale Gorilla? Maybe a longer series about creating a short story or something. Take it from start to end. Do sketches and storyboards all the way through the full renders. And there's even kind of a continuation there of like, a potential training series where we do modeling and, you know, like, all, it's just kind of in general, like, what are we looking to do as far as bigger projects? So you want to start that one, Chad?
Yeah, I'd love to do more bigger animation projects through GSG with Chris. You know, we teamed up on a couple things, the biggest one so far probably being the Happy Toolbox spot. When that product came out, we decided to quickly sort of put together a little promo for that, and we had a lot of fun. And we sort of realized that we're in this unique position where Chris and I can do production in sort of like this perfect bubble where we don't have a client. We can just do what we want, and we can just make the thing as great as we possibly can, given, you know, that we have limited time. We can't just dedicate all of our time to these sorts of projects. But I find it extremely fulfilling and fun to do these sorts of production projects, mainly to keep our knives sharp and also sort of go through the production process to see where there might be some areas in which Grayscale Gorilla can help people deal with problems, come up with plugin ideas. So it helps us on a bunch of different levels. So I absolutely want to do more of that.
Yeah. And getting real specific, I think it's okay to tease this. Me and Chad just recorded a big beefy two-parter tutorial where I make some stuff and I pass off to Chad, and he's making it look super sexy in an environment. We hope to get that out soon. And so a nice big beefy tutorial. So if that goes well, I wouldn't mind making more of those. Those are really fun and satisfying to brainstorm and do all that stuff. But it would be fun. And we do chat pretty often about how far do you go with this? Because it would be pretty cool to record us talking about what idea we want to do, but that's going to be like, you know, that might be an hour and a half of rambling of like, well, what about this? What about we check? Let's jump up onto our favorite things of looking at reference and see if anything inspires us. So it's a lot of bouncing back and forth. So that gets weird to like record and document that, where it's like, you know, all the reasons we don't want to record something, but the process is interesting. But typically we decide on what we're doing and then make it. And record the making of, not so much how we got to that point.
Yeah, it's funny. You and I, our skill sets are so complementary that we can sort of do just about anything we can think of. And that's a really unique place to be. And I would love to see us in the next couple of years pick some projects to really blow up and make. We've got some that we've talked about, even some that we've started that just sort of fizzled out, or we ran out of time, or we just lost interest. But yeah, look for that. We'll probably do more of that for sure. I mean, why not? It seems like kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, no, it's great. And they're fun. So jumping on to the next question, we got one from Lucas. This gets real specific, but do you think that you'd ever become like a proper learning institution with courses that provide college credit or certification?
Certification.
There you go. Thank you.
Certification. That's like a like, thermometer.
Pontification.
I'm making up words.
What's a thermometer?
I don't know, but I know what a thermometer is.
Same as a speedometer. Certification. I can't even say it that way now.
Certified.
I was trying to convert. I was trying to convert it into a sentence that was spoken, and I messed it up.
that sounds good. That's a good question. Lucas, I do think about that actually. College credit's tough. I think colleges. I don't know where colleges will be in a few years, especially for our industry. It's something I think about a lot. How much debt you have to go into to become, you know, to become a designer on paper is so much money. And trying to find, I mean, honestly, it's I think it's a problem a lot of us are trying to solve right now. I think that's, you know, you get School of Motion up doing what they're doing in the future, and MoGraph Mentor, and like, you know, everybody that's basically sponsoring the party on Sunday are in a way trying to solve this problem, which is how can you leverage the internet to teach in a different way than how institutionally we were taught in the past? I think a lot of us have felt that frustration, especially those of us who paid a lot of money to go to college and got something out of it, but maybe not as much as we thought we were, or maybe not as much as the dollar sign showed at the end of it. So for us, like, I do think a lot about that. The certification part, oh, I said it just like you did.
Yes.
Certification, like, part of it.
Wow.
It's a good word.
That's weird. All right. Well, I think we should change. Yeah, we do. That's amazing. How you say
it. Process of gaining a certificate.
The certificate. Wait, now I can't even do it.
Certification.
The certification of it. That's what you need.
That part is interesting because that would be amazing. Like if we had the time, right? Like so many other projects that I think would be amazing to figure out. If there was a way to build the freelancer certification process, the motion graphics freelancer certification process, and here's how you get it. You do this, it takes this much time. It's a super boot camp. It's really hard. We test you on this. We get you through here. We do a big final project. We test it. We do the whole thing. And if you get through it, you get through the boot camp, you run through the tires, do your pushups, all that stuff. And you could prove that XX is done and it looks good and whatever. Then you get the certification to show to a potential employer to say, look, you can hire anybody, but I did it. I went through the boot camp and I can now make this. I think that's a very interesting process rather than show a college degree, which I don't think carries a ton of weight in the motion design community. Nobody's for mine.
Yeah. I got pretty strong opinions on this because we're in such a unique field, and Chad might be able to speak to this best as far as the actual execution, but we're in a field where does that piece of paper matter almost at all because it's all portfolio. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, if somebody's going through a school process and maybe they're a good candidate for an intern, but if you just are working and you make really good work and you show it, you say, hey, I'm looking for an entry level position. And here's, you can see I've got all this raw talent or effort that I've put into it. Then like, who cares about the piece of paper? I don't care where you went. I just want to see what you made and certification.
I had to sneak it in there.
It's stuck in my head now. I didn't do that.
You can't help it now. Help it, dude.
Well, any kind of piece of paper to go along those lines, it just seems like redundant. And if the entire idea is we're in a field where the work speaks for itself, then to regress into trying to do that process at all seems like a step backward. It seems like a step away from what we've been trying to do in general.
It seems like the only time that would come into play, either a certification or college credit, or a piece of paper, whatever. The only time that comes into play is if they filter out the first 1,000 people. That's the only time, I think, is like when the robot does the checking for you is when you need the piece of paper. Because if 1,000 people all want the job to like go work at Apple or Sony or I don't know, Pixar or whatever, and they say, look, because we have the ability to go through 1,000 people, we're just going to get rid of everybody that doesn't have a college degree of some sort. And that's how they filter it, then yeah, the paper is going to like be a part of that process. But as soon as it gets to a human level of like, okay, this is the amount of work, this is the quality of work that you can do, and B, this is the type of person you are to work with, and as soon as they get to those two things, the paper can't prove anything good or bad for you. It's not going to be an indicator. Other than to let the robot sort through you first. That's been my experiment there. That's been my experience. So I don't know.
I think in our industry, a certification is,
you didn't say it right, Jen.
I forgot how to say it now. The certification. Is that right?
No? That's a new one. I like that. We all got our own.
Certification is meaningless in our industry. And I mean, here's the thing, like to get certified, that's like a normal part of other industries. Like you're going to work in environmental science, you have to be certified in, I don't know, you have to know your way around pesticides, you have to know your way around laws and things like that. In our industry, it's just not something that you need. It used to be something. I remember way back in the day, Autodesk, you could get certified for Maya, you could get certified for 3ds Max. I can't remember any point in my life where I was like, oh, they're certified for blah, blah, blah. That's pretty cool. Like, that's never happened.
Well, isn't that almost all the time? It's like, oh, somebody's, I'm not going to say the word, somebody's got the piece of paper. But you know the way a lot of these classes go. You know how the process is done. And you know that almost like anybody could get through that. They will hand that piece of paper out to almost anybody.
Well, it's because most of the time it's like pay to play. It's like you pay the fee or whatever it is, and you know
the class the entire time.
Yeah, you're going to get that piece of paper that maybe makes a difference. And that's just another instance of, like, I think our industry taking cues from other industries, because we see other industries doing these certifications, and maybe it means something in the architectural world or the city planning world or whatever, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything to us. I think what would be more beneficial is if I saw somebody came in and I saw they did an internship at a studio that I know and respect, I would be like, oh, that's definitely cool. Like, you did an internship for the summer at XYZ Studios. Wow. How was that? Can I call them and see how that went? And like, those types of things are really useful.
Yeah. I mean, just to like wrap this up, to go back to something earlier we talked about, is like, we are doing what we think will help the motion designer. And if a certification or a credit or whatever, if I thought that would help the designer, then we would go into that. But the fact is, I haven't seen any evidence of it. So
the college credit is more interesting to me, actually, than a cert. I'm not even going to do it, because I could see that being I could see that being interesting, because you might be really interested in motion design and your college just doesn't have a really good class. If
we've seen it. We've seen the stats on the day that 30 people hit our site at the same time that all watched the same tutorial. And I'll click on where they are like watching it from. And it's from a syllabus. The syllabus is essentially like, go watch this tutorial, come back, and then show that you did it. And you get the college credit. So like, what's the difference between that? And the only difference is the certification. Is like, we didn't pay the right people to like be able to hand out college credit, right? And like, that's the frustrating part of when I see that the syllabus of someone's class is to like go watch our tutorial and then prove that they watched it. I love it. I'm like, that's cool. Like, that we're part of this class and we're helping, but man, I also know how much that costs somebody. And that's frustrating, because we put this stuff out there so that you can learn for little or like for less money than a college would charge. So I'd like to move on, because frankly, like, this is one of those things that get my blood boiling about education. Yeah, education is like I said earlier, is like, that's one of the main things I want to be a part of, is we have the ability now to use the internet and YouTube and Vimeo and training series to find a new way to teach. And I am so interested by that, because I was frustrated by different teachers, by different processes. I always loved learning, and I felt like it could always be better, and the internet allows us to redo it. And I love that there's sites like School of Motion, like MoGraph Mentor, like FX PhD, like all this stuff, like people trying to solve that problem. Just love that. Love
Can
that.
We someday have a campus and like wear corduroy blazers with elbow patches.
Oh, we gotta get tenure and retire to this kind of thing. Yeah.
I think that's what we need. I want to like hang out on a tutorial campus.
Yeah, tutorial and, like, tenure. That's what I want.
Tutorial tenure.
Yeah, there we go, dude. Yes, I love it.
Love it. I want a pipe.
All right, let's rapid fire this, because I think we're running out of time.
Yeah, let's do it.
Steven is asking, do we think that hardware and software will get to the point where rendering is dead? So essentially real-time graphics taking over from anything having been rendered. And my quick bit on here is I think inevitably we're going to be there, but it might be a while before we get there. I think there'll be a tipping point where we cross the threshold where you can do interactive things with these, where a point where your screen is interacting with the person, that it can only interact properly if it's doing it in real time. And there'll be a threshold in which it's like, well, we could render it, or you can get your interactive elements. And I think we'll hit a tipping point where that falls to the other side. That might be 15 years away. That might be 20 years away. But I think just with as everything speeds up, when our phones are as powerful as our towers, like I think it's inevitable. Video game engines look really good. And as soon as, you know, if a company goes and makes a super amazing real-time engine that's just kind of ubiquitous through these systems, I think it's inevitable, but it could be a while away.
Yeah, but if you look at the past, right? I mean, I know this is exponential and things will get faster and faster, but if you look at the past, every time I thought like, wow, I won't need a faster machine than this because I could render, 480, 720 by 480 in After Effects in less than a second a frame. This is the last G5 Mac I'll ever have to buy. They come out with new crap. All right. So then you're like, oh, HD, done. Like instantly 4, 5, 6 times slower. Okay. And now we're getting into a world where there's going to be potentially 360 video trying to render real time to our eyeballs. And the processing power that needs, well, that's like another leap in technology that is like 10 times, 20 times slower, right? If you count up all the pixels.
But not if you're talking about a real-time video game engine type thing. And if you're inside a video game in VR, it doesn't have to calculate anymore because you're in 360. You can just spin around and see everything in real time. And it's gotten to the point where you've got such diminishing returns as far as graphical hardware cranking up that the last couple of generations of like gaming consoles, it's like, okay, yes, it's better hardware, but it's not dramatically changing the game. Mm. So if we get to the point where we get these libraries and the ability to create these environments in real time, like how much easier would it be to be like, no, you're in a video game environment. You don't need to render. You can just spin around. And if that hits a certain threshold, I mean, you look at those things. If you're standing a little bit across from the room and you see some sports video game, you'd be like, oh, wait, that's a video game. I didn't realize. It's a little ways away.
Let's be clear about what we're talking about here, which is, do you think hardware software will ever get to the point where rendering is dead? So when I read that question, I read it as, will it ever get to a point where computers do not have to think about the frames that they are spitting out? Will they just happen in real time? If that's the question, then I agree with Chris. I think that yes, but it might be 10 years, it might be 50 years, I don't know, because Moore's Law is sort of taking, I sort of agree with Nick here as well, where, sorry guys, somebody's calling me right there. And I think that as it gets faster, more is going to be needed. That's just how it always is. Well, I can do it in real time. Oh, well, can you do it at, 10K and 360? Well, no, not yet. So there's always going to be something to push it and make it harder. But so I think that I sort of agree with both of you. But the real question is that, yes, at some point, I do believe rendering will just happen in real time. What won't happen in real time is asset creation, art direction, the work to create the images. That's never going to go away.
Hopefully not.
It's kind of like painting. Like painting happens in real time.
Right. I mean,
but
the act of rendering is obviously going to, we've seen tremendous leaps and bounds of the time it takes to fit, to draw a picture. That is, if you follow that graph, it's looking like, wow, we'll be at real time by next week. Well, that's not really the case. As I just mentioned, there's lots of reasons why. But so I think that what I'm seeing, I've been part of the industry when a render time of an hour and a half a frame was acceptable. So for me, it's like pretty much real time now. Like I don't really see it as a huge deterrent. I think where I'd like to see, obviously real time would be great. And I think game engines will eventually get to a place where they will replace the majority of the work that you need a renderer for now. Yes, I agree with that. What I want to see more speed enhancements in is not necessarily the writing of the frames, but the work leading up to that. I think that's where I want to see better features. I want to see more choices. What changed for me the most about how I work is not necessarily the real time, like, oh, look how fast Octane or Redshift can render out these frames. It was, look how fast I can interact with my art and I can try things. Like, that was the big, like, huge change.
Well, when I, there's so many, there's so many exciting things here. But when you think about, like, Elon Musk is focusing on trying to get, like, a brain interface going for computers, because our big bottleneck now is, like, computers are crazy fast. But right now we have to think a thought, translate it through our muscles, go to the mouse moves something to give the computer one point of data. Like, that's crazy. Think about the simplest version of this, where it did some sort of, like, in your brain, almost like eye tracking, except in your brain. And then the ability to click. So imagine you just had a photo of, like, a car, you got a pickup truck, and then you're polygon modeling it. And you're just like point. But it's as fast as you can think you're placing those points, not as fast as you can think of putting a point, moving your mouse, clicking one time, and repeating that four times to get one polygon. Instead, you're just thinking, like, you're thinking click while mentally focused on a point in space. Like,
that's,
and that could be a while away, but that's a simple, that's a pretty simple application. And think of how fast you could model certain things with just that interface.
I would fail miserably at that.
Having a feeling and going, like, all right, here's the colors associated with this feeling. That's what I'm waiting for. All right, classic Grayscale Gorilla thing, which is we say lightning round and then we spend 15 minutes talking about something. So here's
how we're gonna do this. Nutshell.
No, I love it. I mean, I love you guys. Here's what we're gonna do. We have, like, five questions I want to get through. I'm gonna set a timer. It's 2 minutes. I'm gonna give a 30 second warning in case there's maybe somebody that hasn't talked yet, and we're gonna do question 2 minutes. Two minute. We're just gonna rock it. I think we can do it's an experiment.
You do the timer. I'll read out the question.
All right, you read, and the timer will start when the question is finished.
It's, well, like, you got half the timer, like, trying to decide who's going to answer first. So whoever says the question, just...
We're wasting time now. I'm doing it. Okay. So,
I'm ready.
Besides Grayscale Gorilla plugins, what non-Grayscale Gorilla plugins do we find useful in our Cinema 4D work?
Start.
And I could do this super quick, which is the only plugin that I use is Drop to Floor. And that's because I'm making tutorials and I want my Cinema 4D to be as vanilla as possible. But Drop to Floor is super crazy awesome for things like laser cutting and 3D printing lately. So I've been using that again.
Awesome. Other than X Particles, which I know we sell, but we don't make. X Particles, any other like scripts or anything? That's the main one for me. Chad?
I guess you would consider all the third-party renderers plugins. So I would say all of the above, the major ones, Arnold, Redshift, Octane. I also use X Particles, and I think the rest of it is all our stuff, I believe.
Yeah, like Chris said, it's hard for us I play around with some of them, but it's always hard to do a tutorial and have another barrier on something be able to follow along. So some tutorials we do are like no plugins. Some tutorials we use because we made them to speed up our process. And the more that we put up in that barrier, it's tough. You know what? I'll mention a couple After Effects plugins that I use all the time. One is Real Smart Motion Blur. One is Frischluft Depth of Field. The Trapcode plugins, particular, and a lot of the Trapcode stuff actually. And anything else in my process? I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but yeah.
Oh, I'll mention PureRef, which I'm going to do a little write up about at some point. It's fantastic. It's a free reference tool.
Oh yeah, cool.
Make sure you make a note of that in the notes.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what that one is.
Oh yeah. Okay, we did it. Minute 50 seconds, guy. I'm really proud. That was really good. Okay, right, resetting.
Nick, Brian is asking if and when Redshift goes to metal, will Nick actually try it?
I had to be honest, Brian. I had to ask what those words meant. They explained to me that when Redshift, because it's written RS.
RS. Yeah.
Sorry, you filled in the gaps. When Redshift goes to metal, which I learned is the GPU stuff for Apple. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that kind of what you're saying? Okay. Yep. So basically, if Redshift works well with Mac, would Nick actually try it? I would. I started using Arnold because it was Mac compatible, you know, and there instead of something like Octane at the time. I think this was before Redshift got up and running. And yeah, so compatibility had a lot to do with it. Now, the Nick getting a PC thing is it's coming very soon. I'm getting a little anxious about it, and I'm excited to like document my process as I go through this PC thing. And so when that happens, I'll definitely be trying Redshift, Arnold, Octane. I'm gonna try to play with at least a couple of them and see how it is. I'm excited to try, but yeah, I mean, yeah, if Redshift just worked with Mac right now and the graphics card issues were solved, I probably wouldn't jump as easily into a PC right now. So yeah, compatibility has a lot to do with this big PC push. I know the hardware and expensive hardware is a big part of it as well, but yeah, the quick answer is yeah, I would try it, but by then I might be on a PC.
Yep. Well, it's coming. Well, the point being is you do want to try third-party rendering.
Yeah, so. And you know what? And exactly why, for the exact reason Chad was saying, the ability to change a light, to move an HDRI around, and to like change a texture or a color or the placement of a scene and see the result faster is the main reason. In fact, my talk at NAB this year is all about that. Now it's about the physical render and how to get more interactive with the physical render and make that as fast as possible. But that process of like moving a light and seeing the result, gosh, the closer you can get to zero for that number, the more iterative you could be in your design and your lighting and all that stuff. So that's the reason I want to try these new renderers. So yeah, 2 minutes up.
Let Chad lead this one off. Jeff is asking, what would you say are the key fundamentals for a career in MoGraph? They give examples of good writing, communication, basic design principles, storytelling, drawing.
I would say, first and foremost, being a good person and not being a jerk. And so there's like the human knowledge and technical knowledge. Technical knowledge, you need to know whatever it is that the studio uses as far as gear goes. And it doesn't have to be 100%, but has to be enough to so that you can hopefully hit the ground running. But the human knowledge, I think, is probably a little bit more gray. And when I say that, I mean, you have to know how to communicate with people, you know, how to be a nice person, how to take criticism, take feedback, be creative, be manage your time well, you know, team player, all that sort of thing. So I think that there's so many fundamentals, but I would say that I couldn't list them all. There's so many, but usually it comes down to you can be the most talented person in the world, and if you're hard to get along with or you don't play well with others, then you're probably not going to have a big career.
That's a big one in life. You know what I mean? That's just that applies to so much.
Yeah.
I'll add just some basic fundamentals. I'd say basic animation, you know, curve editing kind of stuff. I would say typography. And then I would add like cinematography, depending, you know, just understanding the rules and the language of film. And if you could bring typography and color theory and some basic design and those kind of things to motion design, you'll be ahead of most other people that are only focusing on the tech and not looking at all about how the, you know, the design of it. I would focus on those things.
Let's see. The next one, I think I might have a pretty good answer for. How would you personally approach a VR motion graphics project where the viewer's attention is not under your control? So for anyone who's not familiar, when you have a VR headset, there's kind of two things that can happen. You can be on rails, in which it's kind of like your camera is stuck a little bit and you can kind of control where the person's looking. And the other is that they're free to just look around wherever they want to. As a general rule in VR, you don't want people on rails. You want them to be able to look around. And I think the answer to this is actually pretty straightforward. And it's to use all the same rules that people have been using to design video games for years. Because unless the video game takes control of your camera and your character and makes you go do something in particular, a lot of like very organic video game design is all about calling attention to specific things and specific items and specific people at particular times. So it's all like sound cues, attention, lighting, anything you can do to draw the attention. Like everything else around can be kind of boring, but something over there is really calling your attention. So make sure that seems like the most interesting thing. And honestly, if you make it feel like people might be missing something by not going to the proper thing, it's like, oh no, I'm missing out on something cool over there. And if the thing over there is boring, they're not going to want to go over there. And if there's a pile of crates over in another direction, maybe they're going to smash up those crates instead of listening to the person give a lecture. So your interest, it has to be interesting, or you have to somehow come up with a way of making that engaging, even if maybe the content was boring, like the raw, like maybe speech. Because I know there's a lot of companies that are doing VR experiences, so it's like you want to guide people along with a certain thing. But you know, like if maybe there's a crowd of, it feels like they're walking with a crowd of people. If that crowd of people moves on, they're like, oh, I'm falling behind, I gotta go catch up. So there's a million things along those lines. But think about video games and how they do it.
Yeah, and if you've ever been, I love that advice. And the other analogy I would have is like if you've been to a more complex theater production, specifically like, you know, NAB's coming up, we go to a lot of the thanks to Maxon, by the way, we go to a lot of the Cirque du Soleil shows. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have multiple things going on at once, but you are pretty clearly that they let you know what you should be watching, and they do it with sound, they do it with lighting, all the things Chris mentioned. But to me, it's in VR, at least current level VR, it's a little bit more static. Like you're sitting somewhere and you're looking, you need to know where to look around. Theater does this so well. Like they know that to make you turn around, that they had to do something very drastic to make you turn around in a theater. And so, just to pile on with the theater analogy. God, we needed a stupid analogy from me today.
That's good. I like it.
All right. Next one.
We got a techie question here that I don't really have a good answer to. How would you set up backups and storage and archival systems? Any recommendations of particular hardware or apps?
Oh, man. I will try to find the podcast we did maybe almost a year now where I went through my entire backup strategy, which is very tedious and very long because I have very good luck in my life, but not with hard drives. So I'll quickly go down. I use Backblaze on every machine to update it to the cloud. I use Time Machine to update every hour or every day to a local Time Machine hard drive. So that way, if my local thing busts, I have an instant way to like put it on a new computer. Every big project that I do goes in a big folder system that when it fills up, it gets to around a gig or two. About a terabyte or two, I will put it to an external hard drive. I'll make two copies and I'll put one at my house and one in the office. And so that's like my ultimate big what if strategy, because the ultimate loss for me was losing like half my student work. I had a really bad hard drive break early in my career. And it was so heartbreaking that I like PTSD'd myself into this weird system. So I'm going to try to find where that is. And you can decide how crazy you want to get, but honestly, once it's set up, it's very automated, and it's just a matter of like putting the physical hard drives into locations for archive. That's like the only tedious part. But Backblaze, if nothing else, go get Backblaze or whatever version of online backup and do that, because if your office blew up or burned down or the power busted everything, just having an offsite backup at all is a huge, huge win.
So my approach is extremely simple. It's a minimalist approach. I got this whole workflow from Trevor Kerr. So I bought an 8 terabyte RAID internal, and I signed up for Dropbox Business Unlimited. So I do everything on my Dropbox. I don't have any backup. I don't have any... I don't know if I was using Backblaze or what I was using, but I dropped that. And so now I work completely off Dropbox and I just unsync jobs as I finish them. So that way they just get off of my hard drive and they're always going to be alive on the cloud anytime, anywhere. I can search for them. I can find them easily. And it's worked out great so far. I'm not so particularly worried about if I lose my system, because I can just install Windows and install the handful of apps that I use in maybe a half a day. So I'm not really, for me, it's just about project archives and having everything everywhere I go. So working from Dropbox and using the Unlimited, I have peace of mind that my stuff is always backed up and I can access it from my phone, from my laptop, anywhere I'm at. So that's how I approach it.
Yeah, mine's similar to Chad's. I use Dropbox for all active projects. Like everything that's important for Grayscale Gorilla lives on Dropbox. And I do the basic Mac Time Machine backup. And I do that like once a month. So it's not even like I'm doing that frequently. Anything I'm actively working on is on Dropbox. So I could have some bad problems happen and still be able to get everything back.
I even sync my Cinema 4D preferences on Dropbox. So if I change any of my hotkeys or I install a new plugin, I do it on Dropbox. So when I go over to my laptop, I fire up Cinema. It looks exactly how it looked on my workstation. Has the same everything.
Okay, awesome. We did it. That was a little bit long. Looks like the last question is another like, what about the future question, which I'm frankly, the answer is we don't know. I don't want to end with like another I don't know question. Who knows?
I have a question.
Who knows? Oh my gosh, we have a question from Chad.
A live question.
Yeah. What was your favorite podcast episode? We're approaching 100, and I think that I would like to know what each of you consider to be your favorite podcast episode.
Oh, you're springing this on us. I'm gonna scroll through the notes a bit, so hopefully you got an answer to start out, Chad.
There's not one that stands out in particular to me, which is why I was curious if you guys had any.
Well, the easy, obvious one that stands out to me that was just super memorable is the one where Nick started it was like the big Mac versus PC discussion. And it was when Nick finally was like, I am open to the idea of moving to PC. Whereas like you could, it was the only time, and I listened to some podcasts and watched lots of different videos and whatnot. And it was one of the few times where in real time you could see a person being like, I gotta change. And even that change is still coming slowly because it still hasn't come fully around. But we, I think in real time, saw Nick go from being like, no, I'm going to live and die by the Mac, to transitioning to, I am open to the idea of a PC. And it's, I think it's when Apple did a big Apple event. It's either when Apple, I think Windows and both Microsoft and Apple had done events within like a week of each other. And Apple and Microsoft's event was super cool. And Apple's was like, and they're still not doing anything for the hardcore power user.
Right.
I think it was that crazy thing with the dial, the Windows one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's link that up. That was a fun one. We got a lot of people looking at that. I think it might be called something like, should I switch to a PC or something like that? Or like PC or Mac. Let's find a link to that.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it.
Was it our take on Apple WWDC 2017? Was it that one?
I don't think so.
Look at the notes.
We'll find it.
I would say that's probably mine too. I'll throw my hat into that ring.
Well, I'll third that one. I'll say this to wrap up. As we get to episode 100, we're going to have a really fun episode 100. I'm excited to get that out. And then we're going to take a little bit of a break. We're going to kind of think about what the next season of the Grayscale Gorilla podcast looks like, what it feels like, and what we want to do. So like a lot of things at Grayscale Gorilla, we have seasons like Ask GSG, 5 Second Projects might have that. And so it'll be a little bit of a hiatus. So if you're listening to this, you're wondering what old episodes to go back to, that is a perfect one. But in general, I'll just say this as we get closer to 100, or I guess we're one away. My favorite podcasts in general are when, two or more people get in a room and not just talk about what their opinions are, what their side is, but also be open to some sort of change. I don't want to get political about this, but I think anytime you can get in a room with people that have different opinions and be open to them and hear the discussion and hear maybe sometimes the frustration or hear the honest question of like, how do you do that? Like when I can ask in real time, how in the heck do you deal with all this PC crap? And I get an honest, good, answer back. That is how minds are changed. That is how people learned, by honest questions and honest feedback and having an open mind. So I'll say this, just being a part of the podcast and being in a room with you guys, even virtually, I love this stuff. I love tossing ideas around. As you could tell, if you've listened to this many podcasts, I love questions that don't have a clear black or white answer. That stuff's not fun to talk about. I love getting into the details and into the gray. And I love that episode because you're right. You could physically see my face go from like, no, to like, oh God, I'm going to have to get one, aren't I? To like almost maybe even a little excited to maybe try it. And I just love that. So I just want to thank you guys for, you know, having some honest and open feedback. Some things, you know, we disagree on too. And I love that. I think the world's pretty boring if everybody had the same ideas, the same taste, the same thoughts. And so I'm glad I got to talk through it with you guys. Unless there's anything else, we could wrap up episode 99 of the Grayscale Grill Podcast. A little extra. 99
Grayscale Podcasts.
Grayscale balloons up inside your cinema and rendering with all the things and frames per second. I think I need to get some water in me. No more coffee. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you in another Grayscale Gorilla Podcast very soon. Goodbye, everybody.